You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to The Real Short Box. My name is Donald.
And I'm Darren.
And my name is Kevin.
And we are here today. We are going to be talking about a little spotlight on the director Sam Raimi. Now, those of you that are big comic book fans, you know instantly Sam Raimi's name from Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, and Spider-Man 3. Probably one of the biggest trilogies of comic book films ever to come out. Basically, he started the modern era of the superhero film genre. So a lot of credit goes to Sam Raimi. But before we get there, we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Sam Raimi and how and why he became who he was.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Sam Raimi grew up in Michigan, which I'm sure touches Darren very well, since he lives right next door in Ohio. And of course, his lovely wife is from the great state of Michigan. And he met Bruce Campbell when he was a teenager, and he was making Super 8 movies. And one of his very first short films was called Within the Woods, which would be the template for The Evil Dead, which I know many of us here are big fans of, especially you, Mr. Donald.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. More of a fan of the
second one.
Yeah, The Evil Dead 2, and the biggest fan of Army of Darkness, for sure. I always liked Bruce Campbell when he did when he got a little wackier, when he did a little more comedy. I think the first one, he was very reserved. And I think when they decided, when they kind of didn't have the rights to do any more, so they kind of skirted it and basically just redid the film for the second one in a way. Bruce, at that point, that's when his persona of Ash really came out. So that is why I appreciate that one much more than the initial one. But of course, you have to give respect to the first film, as always, because if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't have the stuff later.
Yeah, that's true. And then I really liked the first film because I liked the gritty nature of it. I liked how, you know, it was shot during that time in the early 80s. And it's something that kind of touches my heart. And also, I think I told you, Donald, I saw the film for the first time when I was in college over 20 years ago. And when I saw the angles, the different camera angles he was using, I said, you know what? This guy should direct a Spider-Man movie one day. And then when they picked him, I was so happy. I was like, oh, wow, he's the perfect person. I'm so glad that they chose this person who has the talent to, you know, basically film, you know, from certain angles that Spider-Man would, you know, you could see him from, or where that there are things he would do. So it kind of worked out the way I thought it should work out.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this first Evil Dead movie as well, Sam was 21 years old when he directed this movie.
A young man, very young man.
Yeah, yeah. And like we were talking about, Darren got the money from a dentist partially to help fund his filmmaking career. Early on in his filmmaking career, he would, of course, collaborate with Bruce Campbell, but also frequently collaborate with Joel and Ethan Coen.
Yes.
Beginning when Joel was one of the editors of Evil Dead, actually. The Coens co-wrote Crime Wave and Hudsucker Proxy with Sam Raimi in the 80s. And Raimi made a couple cameo appearances in, I think it was Miller's Crossing and the Hudsucker Proxy. And if I believe it was Spies Like Us was the other film that he did a cameo in. So it's interesting to the starkly different styles of these directors, you know, Joel and Ethan Coen versus Sam Raimi, yet they grew up and worked together very closely for a while.
You know, it's kind of interesting just thinking of it right off the bat. Until, of course, Spider-Man came out, Sam really never worked with a giant budget. And the Coen brothers never did either. So I definitely can see a lot of similarity there, at least in the size and scope of movies they usually take on.
That's true. I agree.
Yeah, very true. Very true. And there's some parallels, too, with, like, for example, A Simple Plan, which Raimi shot or directed. And the Joel and Ethan Coen, the Coen brothers, Fargo. you know, both being kind of a crime caper of sorts in the wintertime, and you know, very, very similar in style as far as that goes, but it's two starkly different films. So it's, again, it's very fascinating to see that they had worked together so closely and then went their separate ways, you know, and occasionally crossing over, you know, from time to time. Even with Raimi's earlier work in front of the camera, he was in a John Carpenter film, actually, Body Bags.
Oh, and, wow.
yeah, and he was in a Stephen King film, The Stand.
Oh, yeah. I have that on VHS tapes.
the longest movie ever.
yeah, probably, pretty much. If you watch it on TV, it certainly was, I will tell you that. as far as his career, you know, when we get a little later into it, he did Darkman, of course. That was in the 90s, 1990, if I recall.
That's right, 1990.
It was like his first major studio picture. And it was a success. It did well. I think, if I recall, he originally wanted to cast Bruce, and unfortunately he could not cast Bruce Campbell because Bruce didn't have the name, the pull into the theater. So they went with Liam Neeson, who I didn't think had a name at that point either. But hey, you know, whatever, tomatoes, tomatoes. But it did really well. And at the end, the funny thing is at the end of Darkman, the first one, when he changes his face in the crowd, when he's walking away, it's actually Bruce Campbell's face. So he still was able to get Bruce in there. And that's something that we've seen continuously over and over and over again. Also, one other thing that you'll see besides, well, two other things you'll see besides Bruce usually is his brother, Ted Raimi, and also his vehicle that he has, his car. He always puts his car in pretty much every film that he can. Like, I think it's in all of them but one or two, just because of the way he couldn't fit them in, because some of these films did not require vehicles at all. So how can you put a car in a place that doesn't have cars, so to speak? So,
well, you know, it's interesting. Like, this is something too, like, Sam kind of has a, in my opinion, like, kind of a campy sense of humor. And that vehicle, which I got to see up close when I was doing a couple of days on Drag Me to Hell, I can attest to you, it actually does run. Or at least it did as of 2009.
Yeah. I think he still takes good care of it, to be honest. Very good care of it. And then, you know, he went on, he did The Quick of the Dead with Sharon Stone and Gene Hackman, which I still have yet to see, actually. He did A Simple Plan, and he did For Love the Game, Darren. So that's kind of surprising, too, starring Kevin Costner in that one.
Yeah.
Then he did, and I think For Love the Game was in 1999, and then in 2002... he did the first of the Spider-Man films, and that was huge.
Well, before you get to the Spider-Man movie, if you remember the film The Gift with Katie Holmes, that was his last movie before Spider-Man. And The Gift is one of those movies to this day. I still have, like, such a love-hate relationship with it. But I think it's a very interesting movie for Sam Raimi, because, like, mysteries usually aren't kind of his deal. So if you're a big Sam Raimi fan out there, I would strongly recommend that, just to see a variety of films that he's capable of doing.
Yeah, he's done a lot of different things, from horror to drama to comedy and suspense and stuff.
Western, like, as you mentioned.
Westerns, yeah, he's very versatile, much more versatile than people give him credit for, to be honest, because he got pigeonholed for doing Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness, of course, and then you know, bringing the Ash versus the Evil Dead TV series to the Starz network as well, here just a few years back. But yeah, we'll start then with Spider-Man. He did Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3. All three of them made, like $800-900 million, somewhere around there, in the box office, which is an insane amount. Hugely successful. It's just things did not work out after the third one. He wasn't very happy with the interference he got from Sony, and they ended up parting ways, and he has really kind of stepped away from the superhero genre until, of course, which we'll talk about here soon, the Doctor Strange film that he's working on currently.
So, yeah, no, it's something interesting to mention about Spider-Man. So, like, that original Spider-Man broke opening weekend box office records by, like, massive, massive numbers. I think it was like 40% higher than the last highest grossing opening weekend before. It was something crazy. But I think partially what would have made Sam, and to clarify, what really bothered him is that the studio for Spider-Man 3, they said he said that he wanted to use the Vulture and the Sandman. And sure. their response simply to him was, "You're using Venom and you get to pick one or the other." And he said, "If I get to pick one or the other, then I get to kill Venom." Now, the reason Sam, I think, also stuck real hard on this as well and was so against the interference, other than the obvious reasons, Sam is a true Spider-Man fan and true Spider-Man comic collector. And he's almost like the perfect guy to capture the nostalgia of what the early 1960s and late 50s really felt like. And he really peppered it in to this modern day movie. And I think from my opinion, I think that is probably what always bothered him, is that it's very rare that you get a true comic book fan directing a comic book movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. And it really showed his love for the film, particularly in the first and second one, for the character of Spider-Man and for his stylistic approach. I mean, we all cannot forget the scene of Doc Ock being in an operating table and his tentacles kind of taking over and doing that Evil Dead kind of stylistic shooting. With the tentacles as if they had a mind of their own. Very clever, very horror-like, and it really set Spider-Man 2 apart from almost every other film that was coming out at that time in the comic book world. So Spider-Man 2 is actually still touted as one of the best, if not the best, modern-day superhero films in existence. And that's saying something.
Yep, 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. And the thing that really drove them away, you have to remember, was actually Spider-Man 4. They were that close. They were 2 weeks away, if I recall, from actually starting production. You know, they were ready to go. It was in development. The sets were being built. The cast was ready to go. But just, again, he wasn't going to put up with what he put up on Spider-Man 3 again. Because understandably, you spend so much time putting your life and soul into these movies that to, again, compromise your vision, you know, it's not right. So he made the right decision. I'm not going to have my vision compromised again and have my soul sucked out. So that's it. I'm done. And then, of course, we end up getting, you know, your favorite two Spider-Man movies, Donald, The Amazing Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Well, from what I heard, Sam Raimi actually did argue for more control in Spider-Man 3. And he went the route of saying, "But it's my birthday." That did not work, but the studio execs actually liked that line so much that they made them put it in Amazing Spider-Man 2. That is completely incorrect, that whole story, but, you know, it would explain maybe how that got in there and why it's so terrible, but, yeah, I don't.
Well, it's kind of cool, too, about that, you know, that Amazing Spider-Man 2, at least, this is something for all the haters out there, and there should be lots of you for that film. It had one of the largest opening weekend to second weekend box office decreases in the history of motion pictures, and deservedly so.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything about Andrew Garfield. Andrew Garfield was a fine Peter Parker Spider-Man. He did his job. He did a good job. It's just the actual stories themselves and the direction from Mark Webb, I believe, which... with the name Mark Webb, you would think he would do a better job at directing a Spider-Man film. But nope, didn't happen.
No, I mean, stick to the quirky romantic comedies. And quite frankly, I don't think the quirky hipster romantic comedy even worked in The Amazing Spider-Man. So, yeah, you brought him in to do one thing. You had one job, Mark, one job. And totally buckled.
And then he started doing, after this, a lot more producing. And actually had been doing it the whole time, and we really weren't paying attention. But after that, when his name started to hold clout with people, then they started to really push him. You know, Sam Raimi is now producing this. Sam Raimi is now producing that. And you're like, oh, my. So I know, Darren, you wanted to talk a little bit about his producing career. So we'll go ahead and do that.
Yeah. His producing, it's really interesting to me. So he has a very distinct, and this is just speculation, I don't know this for a fact, but he has a pretty distinct number of producing credits that are some of which are clearly paycheck credits and others of which are like really interesting experimental kinds of things, especially in horror. So like, for example, he produced Hard Target and Time Cop with Jean-Claude Van Damme, which at the time, those were considered actually to be not just paycheck films. Like John Woo was coming to America for the first time in Hard Target. Time Cop was a studio picture that Universal loved. And of course, through Darkman, which he also did with Universal. American Gothic, Donald, which I know is one of your favorite, like low-key kind of series from the 90s. He did 134 episodes of Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah. Yeah, and produced, I think, Jack of All Trades as well with Bruce Campbell. Bruce Campbell was in Xena Warrior Princess, and I think he had some involvement in Hercules: The Legendary Journeys as well, if I'm correct.
Yes, he did, and Young Hercules. Now, where he really, I think, his producing will always be most recognized is in the horror genre. So he was a producer on The Grudge, which was a Japanese film that was remade in America with Sarah Michelle Gellar. 30 Days of Night, which is a pretty underrated vampire movie, in my opinion. I think it's right up Sam Raimi's alley, too. There's a tiny bit of like dark humor to it, which I think he's really good with that. And also, too, like one I wanted to talk about with you, not Poltergeist. That was clearly that's one of those paycheck ones, the remake. And then Don't Breathe. Was all right. But Donald, I know we've talked in the past about Crawl. I think Crawl is, even though he didn't direct it, that is totally a Sam Raimi movie through and through.
Yeah, it's a fun one. It has all the elements, you know, the jump scares, the creepy lead-ins, the things kind of scurrying and moving around in the corner of your eye and the shadows and stuff. And you know, some of the, even the camera work screams Raimi. So it's a very good film. I had to do with this girl that kind of, her and her dad get stuck in this crawl space kind of basement area. After and during a flood. It's actually right when the flood is happening. And alligators start coming in all over the town because the water level is so high. And they get into this basement crawl area. And that's when the trouble starts to happen because her dad gets hurt. He can't get out on his own. His daughter has to come in to help him. She has to try to save her dad's life from these very hungry alligators, I believe is what they were. They could have been crocodiles, but I think they were alligators.
Yeah, and what's also interesting, too, is, like, you know, Quentin Tarantino has this tendency, and Peter Jackson as well, they like to put their names on what they think are visionary independent horror films. But mm-hmm. to me, I feel like Sam Raimi has missed way less than those guys have. And I will never, ever forgive Tarantino for mainstreaming Eli Roth. So I think if you see Raimi's name as a producer on a horror film, generally you're going to do pretty good, except the Poltergeist remake. That was pretty lame-o. I just think that that's great. You always like to see mainstream producers that are giving people the independent star, because after all, Sam Raimi didn't start with a dime in his pocket.
No, he did not. Also, one thing I wanted to bring up really quick when we were talking about Xena and stuff. I went to, like, see Bruce Campbell talk a lot because I'm a huge Bruce Campbell fan, huge Sam Raimi fan. And one of the stories Bruce had was that they were shooting Jack of All Trades in New Zealand because that's where they shot a lot of that stuff, Hercules and Xena and all that stuff. Which would explain, you know, Lucy Lawless and all that. So he was talking about it was happening at the same time the Lord of the Rings was happening and how frustrating it was when they tried to get a black horse that they could ride. And he said, you're on this small island, you know, country, New Zealand, and all these black horses are gone because they're using all of them for the Lord of the Rings filming. And he said, we ended up with, like, these leftover, very mentally disturbed, like, pony horses to use all the time on the set. And he said it was very uncomfortable to work with them. So I thought that was funny. that you think so highly of Lord of the Rings, but then you have this lowly, you know, small production going on at the same time that's really struggling because Lord of the Rings is getting everything and they're getting all the leftovers.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because, you know, with Hercules and Xena especially, that was a part of something that I believe it was NBC in the mid-90s. They had this whole block of TV shows called the quote-unquote action pack, and it would, you know, air on really odd times during the week and on Saturday evenings, including The Vanishing Sun, which was a martial arts ordeal, but my God, there were like seven of them. And that's kind of where that whole block kind of debuted, and with Kevin Sorbo and Lucy Lawless. And also, too, if you take the wig off of Lucy Lawless, she's actually quite attractive, which is something aside you didn't really get to see of her because she had that really, you know, odd wig on.
Well, one could argue that the wig was also a very attractive look for Lucy Lawless. So
fair enough. Fair enough.
Tomatoes, tomatoes there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So he's producing all these films. He's producing the Grudge franchise. One of his later ones, most recent, is Crawl. He was attached to the Warcraft film, World of Warcraft, and that didn't go anywhere. He directed the Oz the Great and Powerful, which I believe they were supposed to do a series of, and I don't think it did well enough, or Sam just wasn't as interested as he wanted to be with that project. So it just didn't continue and keep going for him. But then, you know, like I was saying, he kind of faded out of the spotlight when it came to superhero films until very recently, when it was announced that he would be taking over for the next Doctor Strange film, Doctor Strange and the Multitude of Madness, I believe is what it was called.
Multiverse, I think.
Multiverse of Madness, thank you.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets a little interesting. Just based on the title alone, it's exciting to hear that he's going to have this big playground to work in. And I know Kevin was chomping at the bit to talk a little bit about this film and some of the thoughts that he had on it. So I'm going to take a step back for a moment and let him kind of roll with it.
Well, for those of you who have been watching the WandaVision show on Disney Plus, it's pretty apparent to me and obvious to me there's going to be a big role that Wanda Maximoff, also known as the Scarlet Witch, will be playing in that movie. This movie, I believe, is going to be the big transition piece of what's going to bring in the characters from the Fox Marvel and, to a lesser extent, to Sony Marvel universe into the MCU. Make sure everything is can, you know, basically play with each other. All the character pieces can all be involved together. And I think Scarlet Witch, Scarlet Witch, she can possibly, for those of you who are comic book fans, could do a reverse M-Day, where maybe she actually helps create mutants.
In M-Day, the story where she shouted, "No more mutants," and then the mutants could no longer reproduce, and all that was alive in mutants is all there would ever be.
Exactly. So it's possible with the power levels that she's getting to, so much as getting to like godlike power levels at the end of WandaVision, that this is very much a strong possibility that Doctor Strange, you remember there was a line that Agatha Harkness said to her, you know, your powers are getting beyond like the Sorcerer Supreme, obviously hinted to Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm.
She could possibly be a potential villain in that movie, or if not in that movie, at least be going down a dark path that she may have to be, unfortunately, put down.
Yeah, and spoilers for people that have yet to see WandaVision, but there is a moment in the last episode that leads us to believe that there might be a dark path ahead for Wanda.
Yep, especially when you see her interpreting and going through the Darkhold.
Yes.
Yeah, it's definitely, for a casual viewer, you know, not a huge spoiler, but for you folks who are really deep into the comic book world, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, this is going to be a big movie, especially the fact that, you know, unfortunately, things didn't work out with Scott Derrickson, the original director of the first movie, and he chose, you know, to part ways in the second one. And bringing Sam Raimi in, I think, is the perfect replacement, because he's someone who has experience with these type of movies. He's someone who has that quirky feel for this type of genre, so I know he's going to do a great job.
Now, am I the only one that felt that the first Doctor Strange was good but not great?
No, I agree.
I agree on that too.
In some ways, he's kind of like Tony Stark, but like the medical version of him in a way. Yeah. You know, kind of a smart, snarky playboy. He thinks he's better than everyone. You know, has to be humbled by an unfortunate accident. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Doctor Strange is kind of one of those movies that's good, but it's just kind of like just hitting certain points that it has to hit. And so, yes, I agree. But though I did like the interaction with him and one of my favorite actors, Chiwetel Ejiofor. I thought that was a good chemistry they had.
Well, yeah, the thing about Doctor Strange, I think it was really good at setting a foundation of groundwork. I don't think the conclusion, the act three of the movie was that great. Dormammu is a pretty cool character in the comics, but maybe didn't read on screen the way I kind of hoped that Dormammu would.
Right.
But also too, like I said, I like the groundwork. I think the especially the second act of that movie where he's getting all of his training, I think there's some really neat things in there that you wouldn't see in another Marvel movie. And for that, I think you just got to give him credit. But once again, like you said, it's not great. You don't love it. I've been trying to see it a second time for a while now, and I just can't hit the play button, guys.
Yeah, I've actually started playing it and then got a little sidetracked and it would shut it off. And that's not a great telling sign for a film, you know. But there's a big difference. Captain Marvel, I wouldn't even have started. I would have been like, oh, no, I'm not interested. You know? And it's just because, you know, the writing and the directing and stuff and the way the characters are developed, there's no better argument for a poorly done Marvel film than Captain Marvel, in my opinion. And Doctor Strange, as far as the Marvel films, is relegated to the bottom tier, you know, around there. It's not a highly sought after franchisable film series. It's just not. No one's going, oh, Doctor Strange, Doctor Strange. And it's unfortunate because Doctor Strange should be on everybody's tongue and on their lips. You know, they should be talking about Doctor Strange. And I think Sam Raimi is the right director to do that. And I think what we're going to have is what we saw in Thor Ragnarok, where the characterization, the way they worked with Chris Hemsworth and the way they created his character in Ragnarok, it really brought life back into the character of Thor and also into the franchise so they could carry on with that character, make that character fun and marketable again. And I think that's what they need right here in Doctor Strange 2 is Sam Raimi doing that. And I think he is a guy that's completely capable of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as optimistic as you are. And the only reason being is Sam worked with Disney one time with Oz the Great and Powerful. It was not very heavily and well inspired. And after Donald, we've worked with Sam, we know the kind of energy he has, which is normally very high energy. And I think Sony was much more willing to like give him the keys to the kingdom. I feel like Disney in many ways will restrict him. But I know he has the capability to do great things with it. But once again, those golden handcuffs are a real thing.
So. Well, let's hope that Kevin Feige has common sense not to do that. I mean, as long as he stays within, of course, whatever the budget they give him, let the man use his creativity. And of course, as long as he stays within certain parameters of the MCU, I get it. They got to continue the storyline. But as long as they don't handcuff him too much, he'll be fine. But you're right, Darren. That's a very good point. They have a tendency to be interfering. So hopefully they don't do too much interfering. Let the man do his work.
Yeah. There's another studio, Warner Brothers, that is known for interfering a lot in the production of films and stuff. And it could, to the detriment of the characters and the superhero film genre in general. And I think we've seen that a lot. And it's unfortunate, but it's just the way it is. It's even with what we saw with Blade. Blade, the first one, and Blade 2 were fantastic films in their own rights, completely different, but fantastic films. It basically, some could argue that Blade is the character that really opened the door for all of the other Marvel Universe characters.
That is correct. It was the first successful Marvel movie.
Yeah, they proved that it could be possible, and then that's how Spider-Man got the go, and people saw an interest in that character. But I think making Spider-Man the true gateway isn't a bad thing, because Spider-Man is one of the most popular, if not Marvel's most popular character. I can't think of another character in Marvel Comics that would be more popular than Spider-Man. Even, you know, like Wolverine and you know, the X-Men and stuff is, in my eyes, not as popular as Spider-Man. So it makes sense in a way.
Yeah, I will not be commenting on my current employer. it starts with a W and ends with a B. But I mean, you know, that's fair. I mean, when people hold on to properties for a long amount of time, it's clear that their name's all over it. So,
yeah. Yeah. And Sam's a good guy. And we, not to throw out names or anything, but we did work with him on a project, Darren and I, on the Black Giandola. And it was a fantastic thing that he did. It was for the Make a Film Foundation. And he volunteered his time, took time away from doing anything else to help a sick child fulfill a dream of becoming a Hollywood powerhouse, you know, a film writer and producer and star. And I thought that was a really great thing that he did. It was really great that you and I got the opportunity to learn from him and kind of shadow him and learn his directing and how he does his process. It was very fascinating to see. And it was a great cast to be involved with, too.
And you get a real hint, too, of how Sam Raimi is. I had worked with him on Drag Me to Hell and Spider-Man 3. And, you know, it's when you're in a film of that size, it's very hard to really get any, you know, up-close observations of the man's talent. But, you know, working on the Black Giandola, we did get to see he does. He's not a guy who just kind of sits at Video Village on his phone, you know, text messaging and ordering things off of Amazon. Like, he's like a real director. Like, he actually understands camera work. He really understands story arcs and how cameras integrate into the characters and everything. And watching that up close, I mean, you get a whole new respect for him, because, you know, it is something that I think people often wonder, is like, are my favorite filmmakers and actors, are they legit, or are they a product that's created by the studio? And he is totally legit. You can tell this guy at one point in Evil Dead, for all we know, could have been, you know, holding the boom mic, you know. Yeah,
more likely was. A lot of these indie rooted directors, of course, they are the real deal. There's no question about it, because you had to do multiple jobs in order to get the movie done. So there's no doubt that he is the real deal.
So we know that he's completely capable of doing something like this, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So with that, though, I think we're going to wrap this up. I wanted to thank everybody that's listening in on the podcast here, and thank you for giving us your time. We appreciate it. Make this one short and sweet. And, you know, if you get a chance, please feel free to subscribe to us on YouTube under Rumblespoon Productions. That's the production company that produces the podcast here. And we are also available on YouTube for our podcast under there. We are also available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We are available on TuneIn. Darren, what's your favorite one?
My favorite, of course, would be either Sprecher or Blueberry. Ah, nah, it's Sprecher.
Yeah, yeah, I know. You aren't fooling anybody, Darren. But yeah, just a multitude of, or a multiverse of podcast platforms that we have here for you to listen to us on. And if you do find that there is one that, you know, your favorite podcast platforms that we're not on, reach out to us. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. Let us know, you know, what you think of the podcast. Let us know if you want us to get on a different platform, and we will add that to our portfolio, so to speak. But thanks again, everybody, for listening. And if we, you know, get a chance, we'll be doing more of these kind of spotlights and stuff. We do appreciate doing them. They're a lot of fun. But with that, my name is Donald.
And I'm Darren.
And my name is Kevin.
And if we don't see you out and about anytime soon, maybe we'll see you
at the sweet, precious, valuable comic book shop.
Boy!
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.